Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellas. Today's program features a talk on universal health care given by Dr. William Shao, KT Lai Professor of Economics at the Harvard School for Public Health, and architect of Taiwan's universal health care system. His speech is titled Taiwan's Health Reforms, Lessons for the U.S. and Maine, and was given recently at Bates College in Brunswick as part of the Harvard Center for Community Partnerships Civic Forum series. If you enjoyed this program and would like to hear it again, you can find it online at mpbn.net. Look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you'll find this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs, a service made possible by member support. To further support MPBN, you can also purchase a copy of today's program by calling Audience Services at 1-800-884-1717. I'll give that information again at the end of the program. Introducing the speaker is Peggy Rotundo, Director of Strategic and Policy Initiatives at the Harvard Center.
Good evening and welcome. I'm Peggy Rotundo from the Bates College Harvard Center for Community Partnerships, and I want to extend my warmest greetings to everyone here tonight. I know many of you have traveled a great distance to be with us, and we're very pleased that you could join us for Dr. Shao's talk. Having William Shao here in Maine to speak is a dream come true for people in the state who have been at the forefront of advocating for universal health care and a single-payer health care system. He is a great hero to many people. Dr. Shao, who is the KT Lai Professor of Economics at the Harvard School of Public Health, is recognized as one of the most respected and knowledgeable authorities on health care finance reform in the world. He is the architect of Taiwan's universal health care system and consultant to the Vermont Legislature's Healthcare Reform Initiative, which has hired him to design three options for universal health care for the state, with one of those options being a single-payer system. Dr. Shao is the author of the book entitled Getting Health Reform Right and is a frequent consultant to U.S. government agencies, foreign governments, and non-governmental organizations such as the World Bank, UNICEF, and the World Health Organization. It's now my honor and great privilege to introduce William Shao, who will speak on Taiwan's health reforms, lessons for the U.S. and Maine. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Peggy. It's a pleasure and honor to be here. I first came to Maine when I was 16 years old. I actually came to Lewiston. At that time, my impression was Lewiston is such a sophisticated and large city because I was working at the Lake Copsey, not that far away from Lewiston, working at the Copsey Colony as a water boy. And on our days off, we would come to Lewiston and really had a grand old time. And so I'm returning to my childhood tonight, and it's a pleasure to be here. The purpose of my being present is to share some knowledge and experience with you about Taiwan's reform and what problems Taiwan faced, how Taiwan went about to reform its healthcare system, then what impact did it have, as well as what problems remains still in Taiwan, waiting for the second reform. And then it's up to you to decide which part of this knowledge and experience might be useful for people like you, the concerned citizens of Maine. As on my slide, I showed I'm an economist. But my favorite definition of economist is that a male economist is somebody who has 1,000 theories on how to make love, but have never met a girl. I think this is actually, this has proven with our economic crisis generated from our financial market, because a great deal of this deregulation and that led the financial market go the way it did is based on economic theory. And then you look at the consequences when economic theory have never really observed what's the reality on the ground. For me, I just want to confess, I worked in many countries, including Taiwan, to design the reform of their national health systems. So I hope I have met a few girls before, and that's what I like to tell you tonight. Let me just start with some background. Not necessarily everybody know how big is Taiwan. It's only about the third of the size of Maine, but it has 18 times of the people. So you will not see moose, and you will not see and you will not see so many beautiful lakes and forests. The per capita income of Taiwan now is less, 20%, 25% less than the United States. Based on GDP basis, Taiwan implemented its national health insurance program, which is a single-payer program, back in 1995. At that time, Taiwan's per capita income was only $13,000 per person. So what I'm trying to convey here is when Taiwan adopted the single-payer national health insurance program, Taiwan has a much lower income and also less infrastructure. So even then, Taiwan can do it. So why did Taiwan decide to reform its healthcare system? This is what the problems confronted Taiwan back in late 1980s when I was engaged to lead a task force to design the reform. First, the majority of Taiwanese had no health insurance. And that's worse than what you have in Maine or in the United States today. Taiwan has multiple insurance plans, and to do the coverage. So in other words, Taiwan did not start out with just one insurance plan. Third is Taiwan had high healthcare cost inflation rate. That put the pressure on the government, on the families, and on the business. Say, this healthcare cost is rising so fast, it's taking out a larger share of families' budgets or employers' compensation for the workers or a larger share of the state budget. There are other problems Taiwan observed. It has a great deal of uneven quality of care. Some parts of Taiwan have superb health care, not necessarily matched the best in the United States then, but it's quite close to it. But just go 50 miles away. The quality of care is something very different, much inferior. The surgical complication rate is 3 or 4 times of the other hospitals. And the mortality rate come from coronary artery bypass surgery of these inferior places could be 3 times as high as the best places. But at the same time, there's a great deal of waste and also abuse. Actually, you see both patients and physicians and hospitals actually abuse the system. Patients sometimes trying to really overuse the services. Meanwhile, the doctors and hospitals are trying to get the most income out of the system. And so they are doing unnecessary tests, unnecessary procedures. So these are the major problems confronting Taiwan in the late 1980s. And Taiwan then went through a political process to say, let's first decide on what goals we want to achieve. To reform, totally reform the national health system. Not only on financing or insurance, but also how the healthcare is delivered, what choice do people have for their physicians and hospitals, and how the physicians and doctors and pharmaceutical companies are paid. So it's not one reform, but it's a holistic approach. Whatever you want to achieve should reflect the social values embraced by that society. Let's say, do you care about equality of access healthcare? Do you want to offer insurance for everyone or only for some group of people? These are value judgments. So Taiwan set forth this set of goals. They want to have universal health insurance. That is, every Taiwanese shall be covered with health insurance, a very comprehensive set of benefits. They want to have equal access to health care, particularly to bring up the poor people and people living in the remote areas of Taiwan up to the access of the people who are with higher income or live in the cities. Improve quality of care, last but not least, make the system affordable, which means control the healthcare cost inflation rate for Taiwan. Does this sound familiar to you? So, there is something about universalities of the problems every nation faces. I led a task force of 20 people or specialists. I was given the job to actually interact with the leaders in the civic society, the leaders of medical community, hospital directors, businessmen, and so forth. So this was not designed in a vacuum. You have to understand what are the different major stakeholders may find acceptable. Do they share the same vision? This is what we came up with, which I think is mostly self-explanatory, that we will create a universal coverage and pool the risk nationwide for Taiwan. When we offered this alternative, the political leaders will say that's the right way to go because that will unify Taiwanese. Because in any nation or society, when you have disparity of income, different ethnic groups, and different people with different religion, what unites a nation, the people in a nation, usually rely on the social programs, like education program and healthcare program. So Taiwan decided that all the risks are pulled together. Compared to the United States, we do not do that. If you are employed by Bates College, all the staff and faculty of Bates College are pulled together. But it's not pulled with, let's say, a company down the street. Why do you want to pull the risks together? That's because in any society, there are some people are young, some people are already old, some people are healthy, some people are not healthy. If you study what one of the reasons why Clinton's proposal was never even got a serious hearing before Congress back in 1993-94, you would discover one group of people who opposed it behind the scenes was the dot-com companies. Why do you think they will oppose a national health insurance for the United States? Their workers are young. They usually have more healthy lifestyles. The salary they pay are higher than average. They do not want to pool their risk with the main people. But Taiwan decided we're going to pool the risk of everyone and then have equity in financing, and I do not necessarily need to go through the details. But the point that one point I want to make is the government will subsidize the premium for the poor people, also the veterans, and the farmers and self-employed. You have to subsidize the self-employed for the reason that it's hard to collect the premium from self-employed people. It's not like they work for a large corporation or organization. There's a payroll, there's a list. You can deduct from their pay. Self-employed people, they have to pay it voluntarily. So, and send in their premium, let's say, every year or every 6 months. So you have to subsidize them to induce them to say, I pay a dollar, you give me 50 cents. And then they will join. To produce equal access, Taiwan then introduced a uniform comprehensive benefit package that not only covers hospital, inpatient, outpatient, and so forth, but covers dental, Chinese medicine, home care, of course, drugs. So it's a very comprehensive benefit package. At the same time, before this went into effect, Taiwan decided if you can have insurance for people and people will change their demand for health care, but if there's no supply there, then that's meaningless. So you have to build up the supply in the areas that's underserved. The reform continue to pay the providers, that's the hospitals and physicians, health centers, on fee-for-service basis. My task force actually recommended break away from that. We know fee-for-service payment would be inflationary because fee-for-service payment system says to the providers, the more you do, the higher your income. Maybe the patient doesn't need a CT scan, but if I can make more income from it, why not? We recommend Taiwan to move away from that. During the legislative period, the president called me in. I flew back from the United States to Taiwan. And he actually half apologized. He said, Bill, that part of your proposal is not going forward. He did not explain why. He didn't need to. Because in every country I worked in, I have worked in more than 20 countries on their reforms. Physicians' hospitals, pharmacies, they oppose any change from this fee-for-service payment system because they are the beneficiaries. So Taiwan eventually then had to develop a so-called global budget to control the health care expenditures. And Taiwan's reform is a single payer. The government will run it, and the government established a Bureau of National Health Insurance to run it. You know one advantage of single payer, that is a single organization with a single benefit package that will pay for the patient's services to the providers. Well, you would definitely, then there's a uniform administrative procedures. Taiwan very quickly adopted a so-called smart card. That's what the United States is trying to do today. But Taiwan actually, to plan for the national health insurance, Taiwan actually had a smart card designed as early as 1993 to take advantage of the IT, modern electronic systems. And there will be a uniform administrative system for claim payments. This leads to reduced paperwork and administrative expenses. This is something you already know. And for, I do not need to really belabor on that point. But what's less known around the world is that under a single payer system, you have a uniform patient electronic record. You can improve the quality of care. Because on that smart card, it tells a physician when did the patients went to see the doctor last, when he or she was hospitalized, what was the diagnosis, and what's some of the major treatments. So it provides the continuity of care as well as reduce repetitive tests. Because there's a uniform patient record that every provider has to follow and feed the information into it. But what's interesting too is this, through this uniform patient record, Taiwan discovered there's a significant portion of the patients actually go see physicians more than 300 times a year. They, for whatever reason, they just love their physician. And maybe there's a joke in Japan. Japan also has similar situation. The joke in Japan is this. People actually go see the physicians, they wait in the waiting room, and they actually have a weekly visit with their neighbors and their people in the community. So once one patient came in, and then another patient waiting there and says, "Oh, we missed you last week. What happened?" And her reply was, "I was sick last week." So, for some patients, there could be some of these abuses. But unless you have a uniform record on the patient, you do not even know that's happening. You do not know how to counsel that patient. So one of the first things under the single payer, Taiwan actually identified this group of patients and able to actually try to counsel them as well as find out. Maybe they have mental health problems. And they really need mental health rather than see their family doctors or whoever it is. Then single payer produce a uniform claim records. That allows the single payer to create a profile on every doctor, every hospital. They know exactly which physician really abused the system, which hospital are really not doing good quality of services or really take advantage of the patients. Let me pose a question to you. Out of 100 physicians, how many physicians do you think are alcoholics and drug abusers or have a serious mental problem but still practicing? You say 30%? Boy, all right. I hope it's not that bad. But Taiwan right away was able to, once they established a single-payer system, they right away able to identify roughly 8% of the doctors are really doing something very abnormal. They left the other 92% doctors alone, actually giving them a freedom to do what they think are the best art and science of healing the patient. They focus their attention on that 8%. Create a method to actually use peer review, not through the government, but through organized physicians to have peer review committees, review these doctors' medical practices. Taiwan discovered that's a major savings produced in the first 2 years. The savings did not come from going after every hospital, every doctor, every nurse practitioner, but actually it's identified, then go after those who are clearly doing not a very good job. This is the part which most people who writing about single payer do not necessarily highlight. And so that's why I'm spending a few minutes to talk about that. So what's the impact then for Taiwan? Once Taiwan passed the law and implemented, Taiwan went from expanding the insurance coverage from roughly 60% to 92% in just the first year. And now Taiwan covers almost 100% of its citizens and residents. These are foreign residents who stay in Taiwan more than 6 months. They try so hard to get 100% enrollment by sending people under the bridges to find the homeless people to enroll them. Then who are some of the people still maybe deny enroll? Most of them actually may be living outside Taiwan. but they still maintain an address in Taiwan for whatever purpose. We have documentation that they improved the access of healthcare for the poor people, and particularly those who live in the remote areas of Taiwan. Taiwan is an island, but it has some high mountains and have some very remote villages. So it narrowed the disparity between the rich and the poor in utilization rates. It improved the health outcome for the poor and income people when they have strokes and heart attacks. What we found interesting in doing this evaluation is that the physicians did not change their behavior, their practice that much, because they still get paid on fee-for-service basis. But actually, when everyone had quite comprehensive benefit package available to them, patients, when they have a stroke or heart attack, they automatically went to the higher level facilities. They heard the qualities better. Previously, they went to the small hospitals because the cost may be less. But they also understand the quality of the service may not be as good. In the benefit design, we emphasize prevention and primary care. We clearly see people shifting from hospital services or even outpatient visits to prevention and to primary care. The people did that partly is they understand all of that will be covered. Actually, they do not have to pay much at all. In Taiwan, if you see a primary care doctor today, you still have to pay $1.50 as a co-payment. But that $1.50 is not a heavy burden for most people. Then the poor people, young people, children, and elderly do not even have to pay this $1.50. They're exempt. So then let's look at what happened from 1997 to 2006, 10-year period. You see, United States have medical expenditures going up 7.2%, just like in Canada. Taiwan and France are able to hold it down to roughly about 5% or so. There is roughly a 2% difference. Most people acknowledge this came from single payer. If you can hold down the health expenditures by 2% in the United States today, it means something like $50 billion. So 2% may seem to be a small number to you. That's every year. But it's $50 billion out of American people's pockets or state government or the federal government. Then you might say, well, people may not be happy with the system. Everybody has the same insurance. In Taiwan, they do have a choice of their doctors and hospitals. But now you're forcing everybody to buy insurance. They may not be happy. Taiwan, every 6 months, Taiwanese government take polling as a way to find out are people satisfied with their national health insurance. You see, the people who are very satisfied or satisfied has been running somewhere around 65% to about 75%. This period, it came down. Well, the dissatisfied people went up over 2 years. And that's the time when Taiwan actually asked people to pay a higher premium. They have to pay more. They say, I'm less satisfied with the system. But then you see, once they adjusted to it, it went back up. I can assure you, and you should do your own independent investigation, today Taiwanese people feel this is one of the best benefits they're getting from this nation or this society. Taiwanese who live in America actually fly back to Taiwan for health care, particularly on the West Coast. Does Taiwan still have problems? Yes. It's not a perfect system. No system, regardless of its economic or education or health care, can ever necessarily achieve perfection. What Taiwan does not have an integrated delivery system. Because paying doctors and hospitals on fee-for-service, they do not want to integrate their services. Because they compete with each other for patients, because the more patients they have, more they do, the higher is their own income. So to develop an integrated delivery system, usually we know you have to change the payment from a fee-for-service to a capitation. But Taiwan's legislature decided not to go for a change in the payment methods. So Taiwan continued to have a fragmented healthcare delivery system. And under the fee-for-service system, Taiwan actually continued to have a great deal of inappropriate care. To give you one concrete example, on average, Taiwanese see physicians 14 times per year, 1/4. In America, we see on average about 5.7 times. Why? Because Taiwanese doctors in solo practice get paid for every visit the patient has, comes to their office. So when they give patients antibiotics, that require, let's say, 5 days of antibiotics, they only give them 2 for 2 days. You come back. The reason? Oh, I need to observe you. I need to check up on you. Patients faithfully go back. The doctors get another payment from National Health Insurance. Taiwanese doctors can make some profit from drugs, so they overprescribe drugs. These are the problems that continue to plague Taiwan. Mainly it's because Taiwan has not been able to reform its payment system to the providers. And Taiwan has another problem, is that Taiwan's National Health Insurance Fund is running a deficit. That's because of politics. The unfortunate fact about the national health insurance system, this has nothing to do with a single payer, is in any health system, the cost of health care rises faster than your income. Partly it's because the population ages, so the cost is going to increase. Part of the reason is there are new medical technology and drugs. Usually these are more expensive because we give them patent rights. So the pharmaceutical industries and medical device industries has a monopoly, and they can charge you and me any amount they want. But that's patent is given for good reason. That is, we want to encourage more research and scientific discovery. So you want them to earn a high profit. Then they will be induced again to try to do the discovery. But then the question is, how much is enough? Nonetheless, what we see is every country, the healthcare cost inflation rate goes up faster than the increases in wages. Countries like Taiwan can control that roughly 1% above the wage. United States, the difference is about 3% on average. When that increases, and if you fund it by premium, the premium has to go up. If you fund it by payroll tax, the payroll tax rate has to go up. Taiwan's politics is that such the two opposition parties, whoever is in power, want to raise the rate, the other party will oppose it, say you are gouging the public. So it has been a deadlock. But then I tell you how much the Taiwanese pay on payroll tax. When this was set up, Taiwanese was paying 4.25% of their payroll. If you convert your private insurance to percentage of payroll, it will be 9% or 10%. Taiwan was paying 4.2%. Then it should have been raised to about 4.6%. But the political parties was fighting and delaying it and running a deficit. Then eventually it was increased to 4.55%. That's what Taiwanese pays. Let me try to relate to the United States. I'm just listening here, some of the problems that's in the literature and that I think is all known to you. For Maine, you need to really conduct some studies and educate the citizens on what are the problems confronting Maine. And this maybe is a subjective list. At least at a national level, for the United States, we know this is a case. That's including lack of the universal coverage. Obama is affordable care, will take care of a large portion of it, but on average, still 5% of the Americans will remain to be uninsured. Uneven quality of care, the waste and inefficiencies. There are hundreds of studies being done that has documented there are at least 15, up could be as high as 30% of healthcare in America are unnecessary health services. And sometimes these unnecessary services actually harm the patient. Your neighbor in New Hampshire, the Dartmouth Group, Elliot Fisher, the figure usually he cites is he said the inefficiencies and waste is at least 25%, could be as high as 30%. Then there are high administrative expenses because we have multiple insurance funds. Each insurance plan has several products. Every product has a different rules imposed on the physicians, on the hospitals. So these providers now have to employ a battery of administrative staff just to deal with the myriad of rules and forms that the insurance company imposes. Physicians, him or herself, have to spend a great deal of time to deal with this so-called administrative hassle, instead treating patients. This is what we know for the nation as a whole. Whether this applies to Maine, I think that remains for you to decide. I will conclude with that Taiwan, when Taiwan decided to reform this system, acknowledges that the system was broken. Then Taiwan was willing to undertake a major reform. I think American people is coming perhaps to that point, realize its healthcare system, the system is broken. It's not the fault of individual doctors or a particular hospital or a patient. Second, is the system is arcane. The system of healthcare is organized on the basis of infectious disease and episodic diseases. It's not to treat chronic illness. To treat hypertension, diabetics, even cancer patients. These patients will have that illness for over years. How do you prevent it? How do you try to intervene to make sure the disease or the illness does not become worse? That is not what we are doing so well. The second point I think Taiwan taught us is that we actually know how to fix it. Not fix it perfectly, but we know how to deal with most of the major problems. But that requires a political consensus to do that, as well as people's willingness to say we want to make a change. A single-payer system can control health expenditure inflation. Compared to the United States, Taiwan only spent 6.1% of GDP on health. United States spending more than 16%. Taiwan decided on its reform early, before the system is really out of control. United States, even up to this point, we are unwilling to deal with this cost escalation. And another lesson you can learn is that fee-for-service payment system is really inflationary, and as well as creating fragmented healthcare delivery. In the United States, we still mainly rely, for physicians, we rely on fee-for-service payment. Another lesson you can learn from Taiwan is if you want to move to an integrated delivery system, you have to change the payment method. And that you can expect strong resistance from the provider side. Last but not least, people often don't like to hear that. We learn from Taiwan you need some modest or small co-payment. Ask patients to pay something when they go for a visit or get drugs. China had a program for civil servants, and the civil servants will get free drugs. Then we did a study, follow these people, see what they did with the drugs. We found 1/3 of the drugs are thrown away. because it's free. Let me take it, just in case I may want it. But as soon as you put a small copayment on that, people actually think twice, do I really need that drug? If I do, I can call the doctor, and then I can get it from a pharmacy. I don't have to take it now. This is a lesson from United Kingdom also. United Kingdom used to, and the National Health Service gave free drugs to patients. They follow what happened to the drugs. Again, a large portion is just thrown away. So some modest amount of copayment selectively applied could reduce the waste in your system. Thank you. I'd be happy to take any comments or answer any questions.
Dr. Shao, thank you so much for coming to Maine and speaking. A couple of comments and a couple of questions. I'm a physician, a psychiatrist in Portland, Maine, and I'm also associate medical director of a company up here called Gould Health Systems, and we try to provide excellent clinical care for Maine Care patients, and that's Maine Medicaid, which is 29% of the state of Maine, and have done a tremendous number of quality initiatives, which I'm sure drive a lot of providers crazy, but I think really do help to offer excellent clinical care while controlling costs. A couple of questions that you touched upon the Dartmouth Atlas, and I was wondering if you could comment a little further on controlling utilization, particularly unnecessary utilization, as people like John Wenberg have written about, because as I see it, the payment scheme, clearly the for-profit insurance model and the fragmented model in the United States is flawed, but even moving to a single-payer system will run into difficulty if overutilization and inappropriate utilization isn't controlled. The concern that I have is that shifting to a capitated system, and a capitated system is one where providers are paid by the patient for a global amount rather than what they do, and having barely survived that when I practiced in Massachusetts, I could tell you that that leads to profound underutilization, which I've seen dangerous and, in fact, has led to several sentinel patient deaths that I was privy to. So I was wondering if you could comment on how to help contain inappropriate and inefficient utilization without necessarily having to resort to a purely capitated model. And then finally, if you wouldn't mind, commenting on how to maintain payment rates to providers that would make it so that the providers could continue to do business and provide excellent clinical care without being unable in this society to afford to do so.
Do we have any tougher questions? If I have the magic to answer both questions satisfactorily, I think I won't be standing here. To answer your first question, we learn throughout the world. Let me just say this. Many, many nations are walking ahead of us on trying different methods of payments to physicians and hospitals. And the United States actually is backward. And what we learned is this. The best method we know how to pay is a capitation plus pay for performance. Or the newest term is called results-based financing. We give you a basic capitation rate, but then on top of it, you can get on average a 30% bonus based on what results do you produce for the population you're responsible for. That actually then set up a chain reaction. the whoever is responsible for the healthcare will try to improve its performance based on what bonus you will pay them. But there's a drawback. That is, you can, let's say, set 10 criteria on which the bonus paid. But medical services has more than 10 dimensions. So there's something got left out. That's something we worry a great deal about. And both Germany and England are trying different methods. Thailand actually walk ahead of. And you may not believe it, one of the countries that actually is trying the most is Rwanda. And so we're learning from, I don't have a perfect answer for you, but we know roughly what it could be done. We know the shortcomings. And then the second question is, how do you assure to pay the physicians and hospitals adequate amount for them to really retain the best staff as well as they can renew themselves, keep up with modern technology? That requires very good rate setting. And usually, my view is the rate setting should not be done by one body, because I don't think anybody, even a group, have monopoly on knowledge. You need to have a group with representatives from from the providers sitting there to make the decision, so you will not do damage on the supply side. So it's a process rather than a formula. Okay. Yes, back there.
Given the fact that we, as a country, are choosing not to have a universal system, and given the fact that we have declining resources, you're going to Vermont, you're coming to Maine, New Hampshire's working on something, would it not be reasonable for us to come together, even in the planning stages, and make a regional system of a single-payer system? That way we're not competing for the resources, and we're also offering a model to the country where we can, and it's good for business, we can really attract more business to come here if we show that we're so progressive. Would this not be reasonable?
That's more than reasonable. That's the problem. definitely that would be a superior approach than each state trying to do its own planning. But for different states to come together, like New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont, to come together, it will require your political leaders, including the governor, to agree to do that. And I don't mind telling you, one of the struggles we have in doing the planning for Vermont is, if Vermont has a new system, how many people will come into Vermont now to get health care? And how many people might even migrate to Vermont? The people who are sick say, oh, you have a good system there. It doesn't cost that much. Everybody's covered. So I don't have to worry about that, losing my insurance. And you have good insurance coverage. How many sick people actually will migrate into Vermont? These are the issues we are trying to address, and we worry a great deal about it. So if you have a regional plan, that would be much better. Yes, Joe.
Well, again, thank you very much for taking the time to come to Maine. As a former student of yours, having to drive to Boston many times a week to come sit in your classroom, it's wonderful to have you here in my hometown. And I do hope you get to see Cabasi while you're here.
Now I know the tough question is coming.
So as you know, I'm an emergency physician. I'm also currently the president of the Maine Osteopathic Association. And first a comment and then a question. I can tell you that Maine, in a number of ways, is very much ahead of the curve. We are in the process of developing a public health infrastructure that will combine with the primary care workforce to work to better access to care in the state. We are ahead of the curve in terms of electronic health records and the many pilots that are going on throughout the state, as well as in the medical home pilots that are going on. I will also say that we are the home of the University of New England College of Osteopathic Medicine, which from its inception 30 years ago had as its goal to provide primary care physicians for the state. And in the last 30 years, we have provided so many physicians for the state that we actually have the distinction of providing more primary care providers for its own state than any other medical school in the United States. So we are ahead of the curve in a number of ways. The question is, there are a couple of pieces that are, for physicians, pretty large pieces that are not included in the Affordable Care Act. And I'll just ask you to comment on two of them. One is tort reform. Many physicians feel that without tort reform, we have no chance of having meaningful healthcare reform and access to care in this country. The second piece is physician workforce. The allopathic medicine field has lagged behind in its ability to ramp up for the number of physicians that will be needed. The osteopathic profession has done a little bit better of a job in expanding its numbers of graduates. However, this year, for the first year, we have more bodies than we have residency spots for postgraduate training. And CMS in no way wants to expand that. And as you know, that is a congressionally controlled cap on the number of residency programs. So we have more doctors coming out of medical school, but nowhere for them to go.
Well, definitely Maine is ahead of the curve in many areas. I'm a neighbor in the neighboring state. I hear a number of the innovations you have undertaken. But the but I would argue maybe you have a lot of piecework. They don't necessarily connect together. And so the question you raised about the manpower or the physician supply, I really don't know the situation or the data. I really don't think I'm qualified to comment on, other than say this, that maybe Maine has two problems. Maybe whether I'm raising the question, maybe you don't have enough physicians. But the second is maybe you don't have enough physicians distributed to all areas. And so how do you address that issue? And then third maybe is you have an uneven distribution by specialties. I'm sure you know United States is the country that have the most specialists per person among the advanced economies. Usually, for the advanced economies like European countries, Scandinavian countries, 40% of their doctors are specialists and 60% are primary care or family physicians. United States has just flipped around. It's 60% specialists and 40% primary care. So your question about lack of residency program is really a concern about, is there enough training slots for primary care physicians, if I understand correctly. I'm sorry, I already forgot the first major point you were questioning. Oh, tort reform. That's the one I try to avoid before I'm sued. No, I go on public record on that. That In the late 1980s, four of us from Harvard, a professor of medicine, myself, a professor of law from law school, and a professor of statistics, we made a major study that resulted actually in this IOM's publication, To Err is Human. Based on that study, I can say the current tort medical malpractice law tort is really a wasteful system. Give you a concrete example. We discovered close to half of the people who were injured through some negligence never even file a claim. They just accept this part of life. Half the people who received the compensation there was never negligence. So the money paid out did not even go to the right people. Plus, such a large portion of the premium are paid to trial lawyers, which you know. So I'm all in favor of reforming the tort system. If you trace my writing or public speech, I was actually on the record saying that. I believe the United States should shift to a no-fault system. And I'm not your governor or I do not control your legislature, and that really requires a major legislative change. Tom.
I think you pointedly identified that we have a political will problem here in the United States in terms of our own reform system. And then you showed us how satisfaction and dissatisfaction with the Taiwanese system have been remarkably stable over time with good satisfaction results. But my question is, are there blocks within the population that are consistently dissatisfied or consistently satisfied, and what is it about the system that in Taiwan that people are satisfied with? How do we build from the Taiwanese satisfaction or understanding the Taiwanese satisfaction more of a political consensus in this country?
I did not study the reasons why people are satisfied or unsatisfied other than really just in discussion groups. We did not actually do a thorough study. But my guess is this. The people who are not satisfied are not satisfied for consist of several groups. They are young people, they believe you take in certain percentage of my payout for this health insurance, I'm really not going to be sick, and I don't need it. But they forgot they're going to get older. By then, they may. So I think that's one group. So if you look at the uninsured Americans, even you offer them insurance, there's still a percentage, even with subsidy, there's still a percentage of them will not even join if they have to pay anything. So I suspect in Taiwan that's one group. Another group is actually the high end. These people really want first-class medicine. They're not happy with two people in a hospital room. They want a private room if they're hospitalized. I don't know how big is that portion, but I find that in every country. In other countries, they even fly out away from their own home country, come to United States or Switzerland or England for services. They will be opposed of any universal compulsory insurance coverage, because they really don't take the advantage of that very much. Those are just my guesses.
Thank you very much for your work. Thank you very much. Do you think that the single-payer system that they're working on in Vermont is in conflict with the Affordable Health Care Act?
The charge gave to me actually is to make sure the single-payer system that my team will propose will not be in conflict with affordable health care. Actually trying to maximize the amount of federal money that will come through affordable care into Vermont.
Just wanted to say as well that we did get some money here in Maine to do some work with the New England states to see if we could work together with the Affordable Health Care Act as well. So that's one of the things that that's happening, and we're actually working with the New England states.
Great.
Through the.
But our analysis thus far, a single payer system will not be incompatible with affordable care.
Thank you again for your talk. I think there's probably many of us here in this audience that sent numbers of emails during the Obama health care reform effort trying to see that single payer got considered, and we learned that there was no need for any for Dr. Flowers or any single payer advocates at the table. And I'm wondering, do you believe that the reality is that other interests have effectively captured national health care reform and have blocked any effective move towards single payer on a national basis?
My impression is that the people who had a seat on the table are the powerful economic interests. And they have powerful economic interest to keep the system the way it is now. And the only compromise they're willing to do is to say, let's cover more people. But to control the cost inflation, it may mean money out of some people's pockets. And the single payer could have two effects. One is lower the cost. Let's say the current cost is here, you drop it down, one-time savings. Then second is if the rate of increase was like this before, you bend it down. That's called bending the curve. Dropping this cost down from here to here, it means some people are going to have less income, or some people may lose their jobs. And you know the business world. What the business world wants is a world of certainty. Business world actually afraid of change, afraid of uncertainty. So any reform like a single payer is posed really a threat in their minds, a fear. And all these were at play around the table. And so I understand single payer did not even get any serious consideration. That's why I believe if you are going that route, the change will come from the states. It's not going to come at a national level. Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. William Hsiao's speech, Taiwan's Health Reforms, Lessons for the U.S. and Maine, which was given recently at Bates College in Brunswick on Speaking in Maine. The talk was part of the Harward Center for Community Partnership's Civic Forum series. If you missed part of the program or would like to hear it again, you can do so by visiting mpbn.net. There, look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you can access this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. A service made possible by member support. To further support MPBN, you can also purchase a copy of today's program by calling Audience Services at 1-800-884-1717. Again, to purchase a recording of today's Speaking in Maine program on Universal Healthcare, featuring Dr. William Shao, call MPBN's Audience Services at 1-800-884-1717. Charles Beck is the executive producer of our program. For Speaking in Maine, I'm your producer and host, Gordon Fellis.